Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management, Mellon.com, and by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The temptation here is to start with something about the carrot and the stick, you know, about sanctions on Iran and what the White House will do now. Thing is, nobody really knows. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Shriners Hospitals for Children, providing treatment for orthopedic, burn, and spinal cord injuries at no cost to the families. More at ShrinersForKids.org. And by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in beautiful downtown Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us on this Tuesday. It's the 4th of December today. And let the record show, the president started his news conference this morning with free trade. He called on the Senate to pass a trade deal with Peru, which it did later in the day. But the assembled White House press corps was having none of it. Most of the questions this morning were about news that broke yesterday afternoon that a new U.S. intelligence report has concluded Iran stopped work on a suspected nuclear weapons program 4 years ago. Marketplace's John Dimsdale has more now from Washington.
The United States has been lobbying for new United Nations sanctions to punish Iran for violating international rules against uranium enrichment. At the White House today, President George Bush said the latest national intelligence estimate has not changed his opinion on Iran.
To me, the NIE provides an opportunity for us to rally the international community, continue to rally the community, to pressure the Iranian regime to suspend its program.
But Martin Indyk at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy says without a weapons program, Iran's uranium enrichment looks more benign.
It certainly seriously undermines the effort that the Bush administration has been pursuing, because the urgency of ratcheting up the sanctions, which is what the Security Council is going to consider this month, has gone out of the whole process.
Countries such as China and Germany have been reluctant to isolate Iran from the beginning. John Wolfstahl at the Center for Strategic and International Studies says now further sanctions are unlikely.
I think there's a serious question about how anyone could read this NIE and not think differently about Iran. It doesn't mean we have to, give them a bear hug and sing kumbaya, but I think it does force us to reevaluate our base assumptions and see whether or not negotiations and engagement might bear fruit.
European leaders who've been pushing for more sanctions said today that now is not the time to ease pressure on Iran to end its uranium enrichment program. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The subprime mess took a detour today from Wall Street down to Florida. For about the past 25 years, Florida's run a fund to give school districts and local governments a safe place to park their investments. If you can guess where this one's going, just stick with me for a minute. Some of those investments were tied up in subprimes. The groups that had money at risk got nervous. They led a run on the fund, which lost $10 billion in 2 weeks. State officials froze withdrawals last Thursday to stop the bleeding. After a meeting today, they announced it'll reopen on a limited basis this Thursday. But in the meanwhile, schools and local governments still have bills to pay. From Miami, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch has more.
Tiny Jefferson County in the Florida Panhandle has just four schools serving 1,900 students. Hal Wilson's the school district's chief financial officer. He says the district had $4.1 million in the Florida investment pool and used it like a checking account.
For daily operating expenses, payroll, food deliveries to our schools, fuel deliveries to our buses to pay for pencils and paper. All of our money is tied up in that pool.
When the state froze withdrawals last week, Jefferson County schools were suddenly broke. To pay his teachers, Wilson stopped payments to the electric company.
What if they weren't so understanding and they just shut off power to our schools? What are we going to do with our kids? I mean, we'll bus them over to the steps of the Capitol and give them a lesson on how government works. This kind of thing's not supposed to happen.
Yet similar problems are cropping up in investment pools in Washington State, Montana, and Maine. Peter Morisi is an economist at the University of Maryland.
Throughout the country, we're going to find that governments at all levels have invested in subprime securities, and now they've lost their money. In the end, it will come out of all of us in the form of higher taxes.
Higher taxes, economists say, and perhaps a recession. Florida told Jefferson County Schools it won't be able to access its money until Thursday.
2 more days now our vendors are holding our worthless paper, our checks. This is a somber, very serious situation.
In Miami, I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
I'm getting on a plane for the East Coast in a couple of hours, and the odds of me getting 3 seats across, even on the red eye, and being able to stretch out and take a nap are just about zero, because passenger jets are flying 80% full these days, and it's only going to get worse. The 6 largest airlines in this country say they're going to cut capacity even more. Marketplace's New York Bureau Chief Joe Barchet reports.
Back in the 70s, airlines made money even when their planes were half full. Today, each plane needs to be more than 3/4 full just to break even. Richard Gritta is a professor of economics and transportation at the University of Portland. He says airlines are being squeezed with higher oil costs.
Since the last, I'd say, 3 or 4 years, you've had this tremendous run-up in the price of oil. And this is really crimp the economics of this industry.
Gritta says airlines think there'll be an economic slowdown next year. They're already acting on the presumption that fewer people will take to the skies.
They're cutting back capacity to maximize how full those planes fly. And it's a disaster from the public standpoint.
International flights won't see many cuts. Richard Goloszewski is an airline industry consultant at GRA Incorporated. He says international flights will continue to generate plenty of cash for the airlines. Back at home, travelers can expect to wait online. There will be 4.4% fewer seats on domestic flights this January compared with a year ago. Goloszewski says most airlines haven't got much fat left to trim. He says they'll start by taking our scheduling options away.
If you're in a market, we have 10 flights a day, you might go to 9. That's pretty easy and pretty flexible way to cut back. You know, that's usually the first choice, is try to maintain your presence in cities. You know, if you have to, shift it to a regional partner.
Goloszewski says airlines will probably phase out many discount fares, too. In New York, I'm Jill Barchet from Marketplace.
Lost in the day's events was this little tidbit from one Wall Street analyst. It's not just fourth quarter earnings for the big investment banks that are going to tank, he said, because of this credit squeeze, of course. He said all of 08 is at risk, too. Cue the sad music right about here. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This will be small solace if you get stuck in rush hour traffic on the way home tonight. But if you live in Washington, D.C., Boston, or San Francisco, you're in the top 3 walkable urban areas of the country. The Brookings Institution published the rankings today. Washington is on top. Tampa, Florida comes in at number 30, the bottom of the list. And while it might seem a non sequitur in this automobile age, consumers want to walk, even here in Los Angeles, number 12 on the list. Chris Leinberger wrote this study for Brookings. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Plop me down in one of these places and tell me what it looks like.
Well, let's go to downtown Pasadena. 20 years ago, when I actually lived there, downtown Pasadena was a deserted place. It had a few divey bars and a lot of empty storefronts. Fast forward 20 years, this year Tiffany's opened up in downtown Pasadena. And then there's a slug of new office space that has come in and lots of residential, all within walking distance of that downtown, and now they have just added, of course, light rail.
Okay, but here's the catch. I live 8.5 miles away from Old Town Pasadena, and when I want to go there, I'm driving. And traffic in downtown Old Town Pasadena now is horrible, in part because there are all these cool things there that people want to do.
Well, it all comes back to that great Yogi Berra-ism, which is that nobody goes there anymore because it's too crowded.
Yeah, right.
And that is another sign of the pent-up demand. We need more spaces like this. And at some point, perhaps, you're 8 miles away and you keep on going to Old Town Pasadena, you might decide my next move is into a condo within walking distance of Old Town Pasadena, and maybe I'll even move my office there.
Yeah, maybe, because, you know, a studio, who needs it? Let me ask you the why question. Who's driving this?
It's primarily driven by the Gen Xers, and I think the Gen Xers will be happy to know that this is the first major trend of the era that's not driven by the baby boomers. The Gen Xers were raised on television shows such as Seinfeld, Friends, and Sex in the City, all showing a safe, lively, hip, walkable urban existence. Most of those folks were raised in the suburbs. They saw this imagery and they bought it hook, line, and sinker. I don't know if you have any kids, but my kids are in their 20s. They wouldn't think about moving to the suburbs. Right now, their focus is only on walkable urban places.
But here's what happens, though. You know, the Gen Xers, they try to get a job out of college or at the age of 28 or 30 in a place like Manhattan or Washington or Pasadena, and then they go to get a studio apartment or a one-bedroom, and they're paying like $1,500 a month, and it's killing them.
This is purely a reflection of, and I never thought I'd say this, it's a supply-side problem. We have pent-up demand and not enough supply. People are willing to pay 40% to three times more to be in a walkable urban place than to be in a drivable suburban place.
Let me ask you about that, though, because as you certainly know, I mean, you're a partner in a land development company. The real estate market in this country in the last couple of years has really slowed down and has had some fundamental changes happening to it. How does that affect this movement to this new urbanism that you're talking about?
Well, it looks as if the walkable urban places are being less affected. We don't have great numbers yet, but the walkable urban places seem to be holding up better because of the pent-up demand. Now, this is a cyclical issue. Every 6, 8, 10 years, we go through a downturn. But the underlying structure of the industry is moving towards more walkable urban places.
Chris Leinberger is a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. He teaches full-time at the University of Michigan. He's a partner in a land development company as well. His book on the topic at hand is called The Option of Urbanism. Chris, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you so much.
Every marketer knows that if you want to sell something that's old, you can't ever call it old. Classic is a good word. Vintage works well for clothing. Back when your old clothes were just old, you packed them up and gave them to Goodwill. Now, with yesterday's fashions filling trendy shops, what's old isn't just new again, it's new and expensive. And it is no surprise that even Goodwill is getting some fashion sense. Andrea Gardner has that story.
When Washington, D.C. shopper M. Hall is browsing the racks of her local Goodwill store, she's looking for the good stuff, vintage clothing. It takes a while, but eventually she strikes gold.
Mint condition, vintage, three-piece, men's, Yves Saint Laurent suit from the 70s for $12.48. I know. It was just like, I saw it sitting on the rack. It was literally at a Goodwill sale.
Hall is not just any bargain shopper. She works for the Washington, D.C. Goodwill. Her job is to search for vintage clothing among the racks of donated clothes. Her treasures are sold on Goodwill D.C.'s eBay store, where vintage shoppers worldwide pay much more than $12 for Yves Saint Laurent. Remember that suit?
It sold on eBay for $165.
The money, like all clothing proceeds, went back to Goodwill DC to help fund its job training programs. Vintage sales are an entirely new revenue stream for the organization and are slowly catching on. Vice President Brandon Hurley says the initiative is also helping to change the perception of Goodwill from the old thrift store to a trendy fashion source.
we knew that there was a market for vintage. It's huge here in Washington, D.C., and we wanted to tap into young professional women who enjoy shopping at vintage retailers.
Some Goodwill branches have opened special boutiques featuring higher-end clothing. Others sell vintage and online auctions where prices can be bid past the thrift store range. Goodwill DC stuck strictly to the web so that their core customers, who were older and less affluent, wouldn't be alienated. They launched the eBay store, a MySpace page, and a fashion blog. In September, Goodwill DC hosted an online fashion show that raised more than $100,000. But Hurley says the vintage business is not just about raising money.
It also gave us an opportunity to educate a new population on Goodwill's mission so that we can cultivate them and generate additional support for Goodwill's programs at the same time.
Nonprofit marketing consultant Nancy Schwartz says young people typically aren't interested in social service nonprofits. They prefer advocacy causes like Amnesty International, AIDS, or the environment, which are trumpeted by celebrities and have dramatic messages. Goodwill's mission is job training for the disabled and poor. Not as exciting. That's why fashion is an important accessory.
There are fashionable vintage and designer items. That is their intersection with folks in this generation who aren't going to be as engaged with their job training.
But Schwartz believes this vintage focus presents a catch-22 for Goodwill nationwide. While it attracts new people to the cause, it reinforces the idea that Goodwill is synonymous with clothes when its true mission is jobs. In Los Angeles, I'm Andrea Gardner for Marketplace.
Coming up, stereotypes with a business twist.
Chinese often say, wow, you're half Jewish. That must mean you're great at making money. And your other half is Chinese, which means you're very hardworking. So you're the best of both worlds.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials fell 0.5% today, 65 points to close at 13,248. The NASDAQ gave back 0.2%, 17 points. Closed at 26.19 there. The S&P 500 closed down 0.2%, 9 points. Ended the day at 14.62. Morgan Stanley tumbled 4.3% after analysts cut earning estimates for several of Wall Street's heaviest hitters. Delta Airlines hit some turbulence today. Its shares dove nearly 5% on news. Higher fuel prices will eat away at the carrier's fourth quarter profits. Automakers hit a bit of a bump. Shares of General Motors veered 3.25% lower. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.88%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering 529 plans for those thinking about saving for college at vanguard.com/529. And by the Medtronic Foundation, supporting communities through grant-making, volunteers, employee giving, and creative partnerships. The Medtronic Foundation, on the web at medtronic.com. And by prosper.com, America's marketplace for people-to-people loans. prosper.com. where you can compete to bid on loans to fellow Americans. Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the third quarter report on productivity. The Senate Judiciary Committee takes up the issue of foreclosures and how to help families save their homes. And a House committee holds a hearing on affordable housing for low-income veterans. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
You win some and you lose some on a program like ours. This week's case in point is our story about products for pregnant women and new mothers. We sent Cash Peters to have a look-see at the Mom-to-Be Expo out here in Los Angeles. Lots of you enjoyed his piece, but a whole nother batch was downright offended. Impending motherhood and breastfeeding are nothing to be laughed at, their theory goes. Angelica Pohl of Atlanta thought we had another thing wrong, too.
You could have sent a mother and allowed her to make fun of products that deserve to be made fun of. She would have had better judgment and better credentials. I do have a sense of humor, but the right person has to tell it the right way.
Carson Daly's late-night talk show was back on the air last night, the Hollywood writer's strike notwithstanding. Peter Griffiths wrote to say our coverage of Daly's decision suggested the strikers' resolve was weakening.
No one wants to be on strike, but they know we're striking for something very, very real. That's why the strike has bit so hard so fast, because it's over a very, very real life-or-death issue.
Gene and Betty Hoots own a little burger joint out in Illinois. Maybe you've heard of it. It's called Burger King. We brought you the backstory of their fight against the chain of the same name last week, which reminded Andy Bade of Tucson, Arizona, that he used to stop in after church on Sundays.
Your story brought back lots of great memories and has made me hungry for one of their great burgers and some soft-serve ice cream.
Charlie Williams of Villa Park, Illinois, did think the piece was missing a little something, though.
I was a little disappointed that your reporter, Jeremy Hobson, did not capture owner Gene Hoot's trademark way of calling out customer order numbers. Something like 34.
Moving right on to the Securities and Exchange Commission. How do you like that for a segue? Michael Brautigan of Cincinnati had some thoughts about our report on the SEC and its recent decision on shareholder rights.
As an independent voter with no party allegiance, who was representing my needs as an investor? The division at the SEC along Democratic and Republican lines is an anachronism that no longer meets the needs of the American investor and needs to be radically overhauled.
Finally, Michael Taglieri of New York City was irked with our most recent conversation from the corner office. I sat down with eBay CEO Meg Whitman last week, and Mr. Taglieri wondered why we didn't address a major concern of many eBay users, fraud. Well, we did, but a good chunk of our 45-minute chat wound up on the cutting room floor. Here, all the same, is just a little bit of what she said about fraud.
We, for 10 years, have provided tools and all kinds of efforts. Probably, 3,000 or 4,000 people at this company now work in what we call our trust and safety arena to keep the site a safe and well-lit place to do business.
If you like something we're talking about, and especially if you don't, let us know. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says Contact. Hanukkah begins tonight. Jewish families all over the world, including those in China, will be celebrating the Festival of Lights for the next 7 evenings. I mention China because many in the world's hottest economy have a soft spot for Jews and their perceived success in business. Yes, that is a horrible stereotype. But the point of our next story is that perceptions Americans find completely unacceptable exist and even thrive in China.
This is Bill Marcus.
And I'm Scott Tong. Bill and I joke a lot about how similar our cultures can be. See, I'm Chinese.
And I'm Jewish. We talk food, guilt.
We talk about our mothers.
Have you called your mother?
Now, obviously, we're talking stereotypes here. And in China, there's one broad generalization that a lot of people buy.
Chinese really love Jews. They think that Jews are the smartest people in the world, and they're the best at business.
That's market researcher Sean Ryan. This is a touchy subject, but he's ethnically qualified to talk about it.
Chinese often say, wow, you're half Jewish. That must mean you're great at making money. And your other half is Chinese, which means you're very hardworking. So you're the best of both worlds.
Jewish, the best. That's the perception anyway.
In part, that's because Jewish traders have been in China for 1,000 years, ever since the Silk Road.
Today, some of China's toughest entrepreneurs are actually called the, quote, Jews of the East by their friends and their rivals. These Chinese businessmen all hail from the same city, Wenzhou.
Ladies and gentlemen,
first stop, the Wenzhou Airport Bookstore.
Look at this, the collected secrets of how Wenzhou people make money.
And over here, there's the Jews of the Orient, the stories of 50 Wenzhou businessmen.
That's five minions.
five what?
Never mind. Lots of money in this town. BMWs, Mercedes, Porsche SUVs.
This is a success story that folks here compare to the Jews.
Have they ever met a Jewish person?
No. Again, this is perception. Here's the cab driver.
When do people can endure suffering? A lot of suffering.
In the 1960s, this was one of China's poorest places. Mountains on three sides, water on the other. That forced the Wenzhou people to get creative. They started manufacturing simple items like shoes and trinkets, mass producing before anyone else here.
Birthplace of capitalism in China. Let's head to the open market.
We Wenzhou people always knew how to do business. Why? Because we had to. We had no land, no infrastructure.
In just one generation, Wenzhou turned itself into a global manufacturing powerhouse. Bill, you know those buttons on your shirt?
Yeah.
Most likely made in Wenzhou. And your tie.
My tie?
And your socks. Wenzhou businessmen are now doing their thing around the world, in Southeast Asia, in Europe, in America.
Okay, one last stop, the park. Oy, hundreds of people doing aerobics together.
That's the other piece of so-called Wenzhou magic. They're tight-knit. They pool their money to invest. And Wenzhou folks own a lot of Shanghai property.
Wenzhou people are very, very able. It's all family. We primarily work together within the broader family.
Family financing, the immigrant way. So they're the Jews of the East.
I wonder what the actual Jews think of that label.
Let's ask them. They're at the Shanghai Jewish Center. Prayers have just finished, and it's time for breakfast. Matt Trush doesn't like the term Jews of the East. It's just about money. No mention of Jewish ethics or values.
We have enough negative stereotypes with stories like Merchant of Venice that don't need to be perpetuated. The Chinese people, all they're getting now is some stereotypes, books that you find in the airport about, I want to become a rich Jewish millionaire.
I like people who come up the hard way.
On the other hand, Bella Grunewald appreciates Wenzhou businessmen.
I enjoy their shrewdness. I enjoy what they do. Yeah.
Two totally different points of view.
That's our tradition. We disagree. In Shanghai, I'm Bill Marcus.
And I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Grant Thornton, dedicated to serving their clients worldwide with a passion for the business of accounting. On the web at grantthornton.com. And by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, the smart car, that tiny go-kart of a vehicle, hits American dealers in January. It's a little late for the holidays, but that's not keeping scores of drivers from putting in orders. In Washington today, Daimler CEO Dieter Zetsche announced that more than 30,000 people have put down deposits. 9 out of 10 of them have paid in full. On the plus side, the car does get 40 miles to the gallon. On the downside, it only seats 2 people. On the plus, the base price is less than $12,000. On the negative, it's going to be built overseas and shipped to the States. One final plus side thing here, no more parallel parking. You can just back that baby right up to the curb and go. And now you can go because that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow sank 65 points, 0.5%. The NASDAQ dropped 17 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 dipped 9 points, also 0.2% there. Thanks today to Renita Jablonski and Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, struggling to say goodbye to the guzzlers.
Americans have trouble with that because we think of automobiles as Conestoga wagons that we get in with all our possessions and go to the hinterland.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media. all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.